Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Maya Shenhwar, who is the editor-in-chief of one of the best websites for news and opinion that there is. It's called truthout.org. And the reason she's on the show, she is the author of a brand new book, Locked Down, Locked Out: Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Maya Shenhwar, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. It's a wonderful book. I strongly encourage everyone to read it, Locked Down, Locked Out. I was interested, and maybe we should start with this, that part of the book is your own personal story of your family's involvement with the prison industrial complex. Can you talk about that and the story of your sister?
Yeah, absolutely. So my sister has been in and out of prison and jail for the past 9 years. And so my family has kind of been grappling with this on a personal level at the same time that I've been covering it as a journalist. And one thing I found throughout that time was that definitely prison was affecting her and deeply impacting her life and the opportunities available to her, but it was also impacting all of us in all kinds of ways I couldn't have even imagined beforehand. And it also kind of brought me into contact with a whole different range of issues on this topic that don't usually get covered in the news. Like, we're used to reading about mass incarceration, we're used to reading about the drug war, we're used to talking a lot about conditions in prison. That's something that news stories often address. But you usually aren't looking at kind of the landscape of how prison affects all kinds of people outside of prison and how it breaks up families and communities.
It clearly, when we stop and think about it, it must do that, and it must do so in a unique way in this country, which imprisons more people than any other country does. So what sort of impacts did you find in terms of family and broader community?
Well, I think that, first of all, of course, there's like the emotional and psychological impact of incarceration, because this is when someone's locked up that you love, it's not just like they're long distance. You know, it's not just that they live in a faraway town. You can't call them on the phone. You can't visit them without being constantly surveilled and basically imprisoned yourself for the time of the visit with never a moment alone. You can't write to them without always knowing there's going to be a third party reading your letters. So you're basically giving up a real personal connection. And for people who are in prison long periods of time, especially, that can be debilitating for a family. I think on a very concrete level, something that's often ignored is the financial impact on families, because oftentimes the person going to prison is the person who's earning money in that family or the person who's earning the most money. It's usually an adult. Oftentimes it's a man. And so it's the person bringing in income, and the family, which is usually poor because most people in prison are poor, is then left in a devastating position and often has to then start from scratch in terms of their financial way of making their way in the world. And then I think what's ironic about that is often families of prisoners need to turn to survival crime in order to simply survive. And I think one more major way that it impacts families that's totally overlooked is the impact on children. And when a parent goes to prison, and particularly a mother, which is significant because women are increasingly incarcerated, a child is often just uprooted, taken out of their home, taken out of the context that they're living their lives. And it's really a punishment for the child as well as for the parent, sometimes even more of a punishment for the child, because it could change the entire course of their life.
Yeah,
just in this way. And I think the thing about that is it's not even something that the child can do anything about. Like, if you're an adult, you can make certain choices about how you want to navigate your life after someone goes to prison. A kid, they can be thrown into foster care. They can be placed with an abusive family member. All kinds of things can happen that then determine their future.
I was amazed to read in your book that a majority of the people sent to prison have kids.
Yep.
I mean, I would have thought that even if you believed there was some good to be accomplished from incarcerating someone, whatever that might be, that there would be some sort of weighing in the balance, the good and the harm, that we wouldn't be locking up people unless it was somehow super justified, who have children.
Right. Well, and I think there is this image of the criminal that's kind of burned into the American imagination, where this is a person who's like a loner, whose family, if they exist, doesn't depend on them. In fact, maybe they want them locked up. You know, in this way that this is a person who needs to be kind of disposed of and separated from the population. And actually, often, even when this person is making money illegally, they're often doing it for their family, you know?
Yeah.
So if someone goes to prison because they've been selling drugs or stealing in order to help feed their family, well, that's not helping their family out at all, in fact.
Another twist that is developed in your book is what happens when a woman goes to prison pregnant. Can you answer that question for people who have no idea what happens in such a case?
Well, it's really medieval. It's kind of this weird spot that the reproductive justice, well, at least the reproductive rights movement, has missed, in that you go to prison and any freedoms and choices you might have thought you had in relation to your reproductive health are pretty much taken away. Technically, abortion is legal because it's legal everywhere in this country, but it's not available, really. It would be very difficult to choose to get an abortion when you go to prison. So that's usually off the table. And then in terms of most women who carry their pregnancy to term, it's just this thing where throughout the course of the pregnancy, the prison does feel a certain responsibility to maintain the health of the fetus. Like, they don't want the person to miscarry because they might be liable in various ways. But the pregnant woman is not really considered a person because no prisoners are really considered people. So women might be shackled throughout their pregnancy. They may not be given adequate food, usually aren't given healthy food. They see the doctor minimally and aren't given really any education or resources in terms of what's going to happen when they give birth. And then when the time comes, when they get close to their scheduled due date, often the prison will actually schedule the birth. So instead of waiting for the prisoner to go into contractions, like the labor come on naturally, the prison will actually schedule a date for the birth to be induced. And so the pregnant prisoner will wake up at 4 a.m. with people pulling her away in shackles in order to give birth when she hasn't even gone into labor yet. So the birth is induced. That's what happened in the case of my sister, who gave birth in prison. And in many states, so in most states, shackling is actually still legal. So women can be shackled during labor. And it's great that that practice is increasingly being outlawed, but there are all these practices surrounding it that are persisting. So, for example, shackling is not legal in Illinois, but my sister was shackled before and after giving birth. So she went through 26 hours of labor. The entire time she had guards watching her give birth, but no family was allowed anywhere near her. So we were at home kind of just waiting to find out what was going to happen. She was allowed one phone call maybe 14 hours after giving birth, and it happened in this way that we had no idea when it was coming, and this is kind of the usual story, that we had no idea when this call was coming, and we also didn't know if she was healthy or not. There's no kind of communication with the outside world. And the way the whole thing plays out is that because a prisoner is in the free world when they give birth, with free world in quotes, they're explicitly barred from any kind of contact with anyone not associated with the prison because there's this fear of a flight risk, like a mother giving birth or who's just given birth is going to somehow flee the premises. So the prisoner gives birth, the shackles are put on, they're allowed to be with the baby usually for like 24 to 36 hours, and then in most cases, they're separated. The mother is taken away in shackles, taken back to the prison, and needs to leave the baby until she gets out. So that's the story for thousands of women every year.
We're speaking with Maya Shenhar, whose book is Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. And I think we have to somehow make clear that what's done to pregnant prisoners is an illustration of a larger evil, because I think people could imagine that prison could be cleaned up and fixed up and it could be made nicer for parents and pregnant women. We could scale back the crazy length of the sentences and the incarceration for so many nonviolent crimes and make it more in line with other countries' prison systems, and then it would be okay, and then it would be a good thing. You seem to be making a stronger argument than that. So what do you think should be done?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of attention right now around this idea of prison reform. Like, even conservatives are agreeing, oh, we're incarcerating too many people. That's so expensive and unnecessary. But it leaves this premise that incarceration somehow works to correct people in place. And I thought the analogy that you used in your article a few days ago was so apt that it's kind of like in the context of war, prison is used as a violent device with the aim of achieving peace. So the idea is, we'll inflict continual violence on people, which isn't just the physical and sexual violence that happens in prison on a rampant level. It's also just the violence of caging people. That's a violent act. So we'll inflict this continual violence, and somehow when the person comes out of it, if they do, then they will be a less violent person or a person who's less prone to doing harm. And that's just like an inherently flawed premise. And it's being disproven every day, not just in like isolated anecdotes, but just in the way that, that prison plays out. Most people who go to prison are rearrested in 3 years after getting out. So, and that's just one example of the harm it does, but it's kind of just like a very straightforward, prison is not achieving its stated goals of keeping people from coming back, keeping the peace. So I think that we really need to think seriously about the idea that this type of isolation and confinement and breaking bonds with family, whether that is actually the kind of tool that we want to use to supposedly achieve peace, to reduce harm in our society.
It seems like part of the solution is obviously sort of a change of subject. We need people to be safe and secure and happy and prosperous and educated, and then there would be fewer actions that would look like crimes. But there's always going to be problems. There are always going to be conflicts. What do we do instead of prison?
Well, I think a lot of the answer to this is very situation-dependent. And there's been, I think, a trend lately where people talk about what will replace prison. And there's always this idea that there can be a kind of blanket solution that, okay, we need another institution, another giant state-run punitive institution that's not prison,
yeah,
that will come in and take its place. So, like, a lot of people have been suggesting that drug treatment is the answer, since the drug war has been in the news a lot over the past few years. And other people suggest, oh, well, restorative justice, which is another process, like, we'll just use that for everyone. And I think, like, the mentality that we have to get away from is the idea that you can use one blanket strategy to address this giant range of problems, from personal drug use to murder to theft, retail theft, to sexual assault. Like, all of these things are very, very different problems, but prison is being used as sort of this solution to hide all of them from view, and somehow they're all categorized together. And really, they're all these different things that inflict harm in various ways, if they do inflict harm, actually, some of them don't. And so we need to kind of, like, I think, disengage from the use of the word crime, because that's a category that's been created by government and by law. But it's not actually useful in addressing problems oftentimes. So you're going to use a different strategy to deal with sexual assault than you would with retail theft. And so there's a wide range of experiments that are being tried, and some of them are actually projects that are playing out really effectively. So I look at a bunch of those, and I emphasize in the book that, okay, well, just because this is working for this particular person in this particular situation, addressing this problem, doesn't mean it can be replicated all over the place. But I'll give you a couple of examples. So in this one town in Montana, which I look at pretty extensively, Kalispell, Montana, in Flathead County, they've instated a restorative justice program for all youth criminal offenses. So when a youth has, you know, stolen from someone's house or mugged someone or retail theft, actually violent crimes this is used for as well, they go into a situation where the youth is given intensive counseling, and also the victims are worked with. So there's a lot of attention on the victim's healing, which doesn't happen in a traditional court system. And once the victims have been counseled, they're asked, do you want to enter into a restorative justice process with the person who has done harm to you? And almost all the victims say yes. After they've gone through the process of doing some initial healing, they want to get to a point where they can resolve this situation, because that's part of the healing process. So in a situation where they do agree, they'll be brought together with the perpetrator, with the kid who did harm, and they're brought together in a peace circle. So the kid's family might come, affected community members might come. If there's some sort of respected leader that they want to bring in, they might come. And they sit in the circle and they tell their stories. And this might sound like kind of touchy-feely, but it's not. It's actually, in many ways, for someone who's done something wrong, it's more difficult than going to prison, because they really have to, A, dig into themselves and do the painful work of figuring out why they're causing harm to others. And then, B, they have to hear the victim hear how they hurt someone and how they affected their lives. And that can be very painful to confront. It also can be very productive in that people who go through this process are much less likely to get harm in the future. But the way this plays out is, in most cases, in these circles, they come to an agreement at the end, a restitution agreement, where the kid who did harm will make a promise, basically, with the rest of his community there looking on, to make some sort of reparations for the thing he's done wrong. And that's something that's come to by consensus, with the victim leading the way, with the victim saying, hey, what could this person do for me that would actually help me heal from what's been done? So, for example, there was a painter whose van was vandalized and a lot of the equipment taken and destroyed. And when the kids who did it were brought together with him, they went through a process and the kids agreed to earn money back so that they could pay for the equipment and also do certain types of work that could then lead to them getting their lives back on track, or on track in the first place, so they'd be less likely to do these types of acts in the future. And that's what the victim wanted. And actually, often in these cases, the victims and the perpetrators become close, because they go through this process of basically bearing their souls to each other. And it can really lead to stronger communities and strong relationships.
So obviously that sounds like a wonderful example that, as you said, won't apply in every case. I mean, it right. sounds particularly difficult for somebody falsely accused to go through such a process.
Well, right. And I think that there are situations. One thing that the restorative justice approach can't do is deal with a situation in which one party or the other does not consent to participate. And of course, being falsely accused would kind of prevent that. And in a situation, I think, where you didn't have the police involved, where you had like a community justice process, there wouldn't be a sense that someone falsely accused would be punished as soon as they were accused. You know, and it would be a lot easier to work through that and try to investigate, well, who did do this and how can we go through a process of figuring that out. But in our society, what happens is the person is punished before they've been convicted of anything. Being arrested is violent in and of itself. Being jailed, when you're put in the county jail awaiting trial, that's punishment. You know, so we have a very backwards process right now. And like, it's not just about kind of arresting people and then doing something different. It's about figuring out how so many of these structures are counter to actually healing people, which should be the goal, but is like maybe the last goal that anyone ever attends to.
which is why we need to change. I think there are numerous organizations at the end of your book and strategies to attempt, and I assume you would agree with me that California, having voted on their ballots to cut prison sentences, was a good step. But I was very interested in one of the things you recommended, which was that people should become pen pals with prisoners, and that doing so, they would learn about the insides of prisons, and it would allow prisoners to talk about what happens in prisons, and that it would begin to move us in a better direction, as well as helping those individual prisoners. It sounds like a risky and scary prospect, I imagine, to some people. Why should they do it?
Well, I think it's an immediate step that really anyone who's committed could take to start building a future that's not about prison. And it, I think the idea of it is a lot scarier than actually doing it. Because, like I said, the fact that it's scary is part of the reason that we need to do it, because we do have this image built in our heads of the criminal, the person who needs to be hidden from society, and that's why they're in prison. They need to be in a place where we'll never see them or even think about them. So in order to move away from that, one of the things we need to do is not just kind of advocate by ourselves on the outside, but connect with people and recognize their humanity in doing that. And the thing I think that's also really important is that by doing that, you're not just taking a political step, like building a connection that could lead to some kind of political action, or just, you know, reaching out and building a friendship and in a way that isn't usually recognized as possible. But you're also doing harm reduction, because people who are locked up, if they're perceived as not having connections on the outside, they're much more likely to be put in a position of being exploited and abused by authority figures. And also they're more likely to harm themselves, honestly. There's something very, very just soul-sucking about feeling alone in a space like that. And any way that you can provide some form of connection is, I think, just really a powerful action.
Excellent advice, and there are resources on how you can do that at the end of the book. Locked Down, Locked Out: Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better, by Maya Shenhuar. Maya, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate it.
You should check out Maya's work at truthout.org. We will have a link to it from talknationradio.org. I will also post a link to the article I wrote that Maya referred to, comparing prison with war. I don't know if seeing a common root of both of those peculiarly evil institutions will help us end them, but I suspect it might. Speaking of evil institutions, Congress is back and up to no good. Go to rootsaction.org and get involved. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.